Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show. So every first Monday, we chat with military history author, like what, 21 books, I think it is right now that Mike Guardia has written and published with different places. And he is an award-winning author. So not just an author, but he really focuses on military history. He's also a U.S. Army veteran. He was named Author of the Year in 2021 by the Military Writers Society of America. And you may have seen him on the History Channel series, I Was There. He was a featured historian in the episodes of the Johnstown Flood of 1889, the Chernobyl disaster, the Battle of Stalingrad, and the Oklahoma City bombing. And his latest book, go get it. It's very, very cool. It is called The Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Frontlines of World War II. So his website is mikeguardia.com. And you can also hear his interviews with us on blendradioandtv.com. So every first Monday, tune in for his episodes with us. And today we're going to be talking about leadership lessons from the military, military heroes. You know, life throws us curveballs, right? Whether they're personal, whether they're at work, whether, you know, if you're going through school, life is just not a bowl of cherries, right? As we might say. You know, we're going to talk about how to get out of those situations, looking at three gentlemen who have all served and have all been covered in Mike's books. One of the books is coming out this fall. So we're going to talk about Hal Moore, also Paul Gorman. And then we're going to talk about Mike's newest book coming out and kind of get those stories of leadership. So welcome back, Mike. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Hey, so are you enjoying summer in Minnesota?
Oh, yeah.
That'd be beautiful, yeah. Right?
Oh, it is. This is probably like the only 3 months of qualitatively nice weather that we have.
Oh, wow.
So I got to enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because the cold's going to sneak up on you.
It's coming. I know. Isn't that weird?
Like, isn't that weird?
So because you think, you know, it's all warm and everyone's going through a heat wave. And then all of a sudden you turn around and it's like, what? Because fall is not necessarily easy, warm. Right? Up there.
I think the temperature starts to drop a lot around mid-October. So, it's like, I think that's really the big shift. You know, you start getting down into like the 40s and the 30s and stuff like that. Mm. And it's all downhill for probably the next 6 months before the first thaw.
Wow. Well,
we talk about the weather, but this is something about when you're serving in the military, whether you're in training or actually out in battle, right? The weather doesn't necessarily go with what you want, right? So, you know, I was looking, even the Civil War was fought over, you know, some of the hottest, most humid days and some of like World War II. You did a World War II looking at Christmas Eve in snow for, you know, the soldiers, your children's book. So it's kind of like that's a whole other deal for overcoming what you maybe are not used to as a human being. Does the military help you with acclimation to weather? Like if Hal Moore, who we're going to be talking about, and you've got three books on Hal Moore, going to Vietnam, do you think he was ready for that?
I think so. You know, one thing that I've noticed is that at least in these modern times, there is a big effort to try to acclimatize any soldier before he goes anywhere. You know, I think that in Hal Moore's case, he was lucky in the sense that he was doing the bulk of his training in the middle of Georgia in what was the dead of summer, which is pretty comparable to the heat and the humidity that you would experience in South Vietnam. So, you know, you try to have these different training spots and you try to have these different, try to have these different training places all over the world in a lot of different environments. So you can replicate a lot of the conditions that you will see on the ground once you go anywhere.
Well, like 29 Palms. I mean, that's a good place.
NTC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Louisiana, doing the Louisiana maneuvers. We still got to do a show on that.
Yeah.
Actually, they're recreating that. They're driving tanks. Next year, or I'm going to have to, I'll email you on this. There's a whole effort where they're taking all these historic tanks and driving them down the streets of Louisiana, of where the Louisiana maneuvers happened, which is pretty cool. So maybe that'll be my chance to go in and take a peek in a tank and have a look at what you went through, you know, and see what it was like. But Hal Moore, so this is we're talking about three gentlemen today. Hal Moore, you wrote this book with Hal Moore, the late General Hal Moore. Hal Moore on Leadership, Winning When Outgunned and Outnumbered. So he was your first pick of really talking about sharing a story, having been to the museum and read your three books, we could be here all day talking about lessons in leadership from Hal Moore. But what really stands out to you about him that when you think about going through life's challenges, because the world is right now, everybody kind of feels challenged, whether it's inflation, whether it's COVID, whether it's climate change, whether everybody's changing jobs. I mean, it just is a kind of a crazy period. So I'm really glad we're doing this. What was it about him that you decided? I mean, I know that's like a dumb question, but.
Well, gosh, I think if I can narrow it down to really only a few tenets, it would probably be one is that whatever life threw at him, he was very easily adaptable. And he was adaptive to any number of the circumstances that he faced. And what I admired about him probably more than anything was his ability to keep a cool head and his ability to really contain his emotions and not overreact. I mean, I think that was the one recurring theme that came back to us in all the conversations that I had with him was that, you know, don't overreact. And more importantly, don't overreact to an overreaction. Because when you do that, things only escalate and it will take the situation to places where you absolutely do not want it to go. So that I think has been the most critical thing that I've taken away from those conversations. And really the thing that I try to reiterate to any number of the students that I have taught at the college level. It's like, you know, there are going to be very unpleasant situations that you find yourself in, but probably the one thing more than anything else that will increase your chances of coming out on the other end of that successfully is do not overreact.
That's hard, especially for women.
Right.
I was reading the other day about a school shooting, which is so unfortunate. I mean, I think this is crazy where kids are shooting other kids. And this one little girl covered herself in blood and pretended to be dead. And now before, I think she's 13. That I find on the one level, I find it horrific that she should ever, or anyone should ever have to do that. But the sense that she had to do that and it saved her life. I mean, I think it's pretty amazing. It's horrible that our children should have to go through anything like that. And I'm hoping in the future schools will do something security-wise that can prevent. But, you know, when you think about it, there's certain people who just have this ability to keep a cool head, think it through, and take an action. Not everybody has that. I think, you know, if they could calm down and but, you know, maybe some people just can't calm down. Mm. And, you know, when they're looking at a 13-year-old, I find it amazing. So I'm, you know, I hope I get to see more of what this girl does in her future.
Well, I think it is a learnable skill. It's just something that takes a lot of conscious effort. And I think it's best to learn it really as part of your formative years, because I think the adult mind, once it gets to a certain point, you know, probably maybe ballpark 50 years old or so. I mean, I think the ability to get out of being set in your ways is exponentially harder.
I love what
now
you're talking about.
Now be careful
this.
There.
I know. I'm like, I'm getting towards there, Mike. I'm not there yet, but it's looming. It's saying, come hither. But, you know, it's
well,
coming.
Me too.
It's like, dude, what is happening? But when you look at this, it's, I feel like a lot of the reactions is fear. And when you think about being in Vietnam, like Hal Moore was, and I think you should give everyone a little background on Hal Moore, just in case you don't know who Hal Moore is. He's legendary. But going to Vietnam and all these situations, a new war, it wasn't like World War II. It was a different, completely different war. I mean, the Korean War was before, so there's that too. But that, I mean, there's fear. And he talks about being outgunned, not just outmanned, outnumbered, outgunned, and to not lose your cool and freak out. I mean, I think about, you know, we've talked about prisoners of war on the show. How do you not just really, you can't. And there's people that just held on to the information no matter what torture. So that's that same mentality, right? To be able to go through that.
Right. Mm. Absolutely, it is. You see those recurring stories of resilience.
Does the military teach that?
Well, it does to an extent, I think. I don't think it does it directly. It's more something that they teach as a matter of indirect course. And I think really they do that through all of the stressful situations that they put you through whenever you're in a basic training environment. Mm-hmm. Because from what I understand, and even when I look back on my own experiences, you know, they try to make it as intentionally stressful and as intentionally difficult as possible to try to get you used to dealing with that level of stress. And I think the baseline argument that they use for that is, well, you know, hey, we want to make sure that you can function if somebody is screaming at you, because if you have that as your foundation, then you're much more likely to be able to function, you know, when grenades start going off and stuff.
Yeah.
I think they teach that indirectly as a part of all the different course modules that they have. And, you know, it, and I think really, you know, it's almost ironic, but I think that throughout the course of anyone's military career, you will be assigned to units where you serve under toxic leaders, or you serve under leaders who either intentionally or intentionally will try to make things much more difficult than they have to be. And you know, when you serve in an environment and under a leadership structure like that, I think it I think that also in a very indirect sense makes you more resilient, because you know, you for lack of a better term, you have to put up with other people's nonsense, and it's nonsense that you probably would not deal with in any other organization.
And that's the same thing, like, well, and this is Matt, this is I think why it's so important to do this show, and I know we're going to do part two next month,
right?
Is that we're talking matters of life and death. So we're talking about this with, you know, medical personnel, military, pilots, anybody in those situations. And when we think about being at work and having a real crappy boss, and then you start getting into the gossip machine, and then everybody starts the whining thing, that doesn't really get you anywhere. I mean, you can have your moment, but it really doesn't get you there. I remember growing up, you know, as you know, had a little bit of a different lifestyle. And Nancy would always tell me, you can freak out after the situation. She says, during a situation, if you become basically a baby, that's a luxury. You do not have luxuries during situations. That is a luxury. And that is something you can, once a situation is over, look back on, then you can do your thing. But I think in the military, even in a battle, you don't even have time, right, to kind of
freak out.
I mean, you know, I think it's a luxury that no serviceman or any type of service personnel can really have. I mean, and I don't think that that's I don't think that's limited to the military. I think it extends to police officers and first responders as well.
Yeah, that's medical, your pilot, you know.
Well, because it actually makes you weak. You're expending all your energy and emotion in the wrong place at the wrong time. Right. You can freak out after if you need to, that's fine, whatever. Mm-hmm. But during an emergency or a battle or whatever, to me, in my mind, I'm like, dude, lay low and be calm, cool, collected, and suss it out and see what avenue is the best avenue for you personally to take. And if you have others with you that you're caring for, absolutely, what's the best way out? What's the best thing to do? And if you're freaking out and screaming and yelling and crying, you can't think and do that at the same time.
I don't think
you can. I think you have to choose it. The luxury, I think it's a luxury to have the emotions opposed, you know,
and
I'm
you
not
can
saying
feel
that
them later
though. Yeah. Feel stuff. I'm just saying that during an emergency, to me, a luxury to freak out, that's a luxury. It's not a best choice, doesn't help anybody. And it's kind of a breakdown.
As a performer and even doing live radio shows, we all have stuff that goes wrong. And we've done live on location things where internet, we've been in haunted buildings even with like weird stuff. I mean, really weird stuff. And I mean, I've run through hotels and like moved people off the front desk and taken over. I mean, it's like, it's crazy, you know, taking over their internet and whatever. During a live show, and you cannot freak out. You can laugh on that kind of thing, but
well, it's funny.
You know, it's kind of a different thing. Mm-hmm. Performers have that. The show must go on. Look at the Titanic. Yeah. When the Titanic was going down, the band kept playing. I mean, it's like, you got to keep the show.
Band played on.
Yeah, I mean, that's like this famous thing. Can you give everyone, this will introduce those who don't know about Halmore. So everybody, again, Mike, 21 books. I hope I've got that right. Is it 22? I might be screwing that up. But it's over 20 books. 24.
Yeah.
24?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Apparently,
I
can't count.
I lost count after 21. So.
No, that's what it is. I think that's why it's still stuck in my head, 21. It's like, I can't count past that because I'm still 21. But so I'm staying there. But
that's good because I get to be younger then.
Yeah, okay, there you go. So the thing is, Halmore, you've got 3 books on him. So everyone, MikeWardia.com, go to Amazon, all that great place. But and just give a example of that leadership under fire of not losing his cool.
Okay, well, let's see. To anyone out there who is not already familiar with Halmore, if you saw the 2002 film We Were Soldiers, that is a film that stars Mel Gibson, and Mel Gibson in that film, he plays Halmore, and that chronicles Halmore's leadership in the context of the Battle of Ayudhran. And just one example that I can point to within that battle was probably the second day of the battle, where they knew they had casualties mounting, and they knew that they had one platoon that was cut off from the rest of its company, and they knew that they were going to have to send a rescue force out there to recover that platoon, assuming there was anyone left alive. He knew that the odds at that point were not in his favor, but he said, the thing that really helped me through was, one, knowing that we could default to our training, because when you're in any type of a stressful situation, you will always default to whatever your lowest level of training is. And I knew that all the training that we had been through up to that point was going to see us through. I also knew that we had very tight communication, and I knew that we had a lifeline, so to speak, with the supporting artillery and also the close air support that we had throughout the campaign. So I knew that that was going to be an equalizer. I knew that if I could harness all of those indirect fires and that close air support, that that would keep the NVA and VC units from outflanking us and being able to overrun our position. And if we could gain ground, even if it was only inches at a time, then we would show the enemy that even in the face of enemy fire, that we were not going to buckle. And yeah, the best analogy that I think I can use for that is to try to liken it to a football game where you're just moving the ball down the gridiron only 1 yard at a time.
So this is a really good lesson, because he goes to, what do I have? What do we have as a team? So as a leader, it's not just about me. It's a team. What do we have? So going to the positive, you know, from there you gain strength instead of going, well, we don't have this.
So, and I think it's several times throughout that fight, it would have been incredibly easy for him to do that, but no, he just said, well, hey, you know, I have confidence in our equipment. I have confidence in our training. I have confidence in all of the supporting assets that we have. So, you know, knowing that I am tied to a timeline that can only bring back reinforcements via helicopter, maybe every 15 to 45 minutes, if we're lucky, that, you know, I know that we're going to see this. I know that we're going to see this thing through to the end. And I know that we are going to come out on top.
This is, you know, such a good, I love that. It's so good. I mean, it's resilience, you know, it's like gives you that backbone. So Hal Moore, everyone, and definitely, again, Mike's got three books on Hal Moore, but don't you still teach his lessons in leadership? Do you still go and do speaking engagements on that?
I do.
That's awesome. So MikeGuardia.com, everybody. Sorry, I got to be the plug queen here. All right. So now Paul Gorman is the other gentleman you want to talk about. Your book, Danger Forward, chronicles his story. And am I allowed to say he's a badass? Like, I mean, pretty much everyone you're talking about, they're badasses, right?
I agree.
But yeah, it's given, because this was, when did this come out? Was it last year?
See, this was, this was just last year, 2021.
Yeah. So I remember going, holy cow. But give everyone an overview of Paul Gorman, and then let's get into the nitty gritty of his leadership lesson.
Alrighty,
or life lessons, really. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So Paul Gorman, he is a 1950 West Point graduate. And let's see, if I can give you an executive summary of everything that he has done. You know, he was a young combat leader in the Korean War. He graduates, really quite literally just in time to graduates just in time to serve in Korea. And you know, he cuts his teeth on combat at the Battle of Porkchop Hill, and decides to stay in the military afterwards, you know. And his baptism by fire on the hilltops of North Korea is one for which he is awarded for valor. You know, he stays in, he's in the inaugural years of this thing we call the Cold War. And fast forward into the 1960s, this is the start of our combat mission in Vietnam. He is the commander of American forces at the Battle of Bong Trang, where he is awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. And not only that, after he redeploys from his first tour in Vietnam, he's working in the Pentagon, where he becomes the chief architect of the Pentagon Papers. And and then owing to that, he gets selected to be a delegate to the Paris Peace Accords, and you know, he's actually trying to broker a peace settlement with North Vietnam, and afterwards he of course stays in the military. Beyond that, he is instrumental in rebuilding the army from its post-Vietnam malaise. And then after all of that, he takes command of U.S. Southern Command at a time when it is probably the most intense period in modern Latin American history. you know, because when he takes over Southern Command, yeah, he has a slew of problems that are stretching from the southern end of Mexico all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, you know, and not the least of which was the Sandinistas and the Contras, the invasion of Grenada, you know, the ongoing love-hate relationship with Manuel Noriega. Yeah, he was there, had a front row seat for all of it.
Wow.
Yeah. Which one was it, him or maybe I'm completely wrong, or Hal Moore that taught themselves math in the bathroom?
Who was that? Hal Moore.
That was Hal Moore. Okay. I'm just like, I'll never forget that part. You know, just I got my guys mixed up there. But you know, that he just, Paul Gorman just kept going and going and going. And I'll never forget that about the Pentagon Papers going like, you just didn't stop, you know. Do you think West Point helped him in his mindset and training of continuing to move forward? Because he, to me, he's like a rhino where you can't stop him from charging.
Yeah, well, I don't think that West Point necessarily helped him in that regard. I think it was really just something he was born with. And I think he would have developed it regardless of any college that he went to. But I think that what it did for him was, you know, just take what was already there and maybe refine it for him a little bit more. Built on that solid foundation that he already had.
Was he the one who lacked West Point or didn't? One of them didn't. I'm getting them all meddled up here.
I don't think either of them liked it, really.
Yeah. I remember one of them thought that it could do better. That it could do better or something. I remember something about that.
Yeah.
But this,
as a matter of fact, Don Starry said that as well.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's I think that's where it all started. Yeah, that they just thought it could be better, you know.
Right.
And I just, the first time I heard about West Point was learning Civil War history. Mm-hmm. You know, about going to West Point was a big deal, and now it's like it's just the history of that is pretty incredible. So, what story would you say would be a good life lesson from Paul Gorman?
Well, let's see. If
my gosh.
That's
what's hard about this. I mean, it's like, yeah.
Right.
Well, you might have to write another book on him.
Yeah. So I really think the biggest overall takeaway from Paul Gorman would be always to think outside the box. And that was something that he was not afraid to do. Because I think too often we really tend to put ourselves, you know, lockstep into whatever organizational culture we find ourselves in. Mm-hmm. And he was not afraid to step on anybody's toes. And you know, he was one who he never wanted to find himself being someone who was missing the forest for the trees. You know, he said, you know, hey, look, if I want to get to the front lines of Korea, but the army is giving me orders to go someplace else, let me think outside the box of how I can manipulate the system to my advantage. Because I think I would be better serving the army on the front lines in Korea than I would, you know, manning the Iron Curtain in Germany. So let me get on a train all the way over to San Francisco to Camp Stoneman so I can, you know, say, hi, here I am. My name's Paul Gorman, and I'm supposed to have orders to go to Korea.
Yes, I love this story.
I love it.
And
so cool.
And then all of the base personnel reviewing their documents saying, well, gosh, Gorman, I don't seem to have your name on my list. And then Paul says, okay, well, you know what? That's okay. I'm going to get on the phone with the Pentagon right now, and I'm going to try to find out what happened to my orders. And then calls him up and says, hi, I'm Paul Gorman. I am here at Camp Stoneman right now. I'm supposed to get on the boat to go to Korea, but gosh, I don't have any orders. Can you help me out? And, you know, probably in a case of this hand not talking to this hand, the person at the Pentagon just calls Stoneman and says, hey, this guy's supposed to have orders, so I'm going to send him right over. I think it was that attitude of, you know, hey, I'm not going to have anybody put me inside of a box this big. I'm going to what I need to do in order to be of the amount of usefulness that I know that I can be.
And, I think that's amazing. Yeah. You know, the courage.
That's one of my favorite stories in this book. Yeah.
I mean, to go to that length.
Right.
You know, and to really make it happen. I love that.
You have to have some spitfire and chutzpah to do that.
Oh,
too.
Yeah.
Because you get in trouble, like you're going to get in trouble, you know?
Right.
But then I think if you got caught, they're going to look at you and go, all right, you really want it that bad. You know what I mean? You might get like a pat on the wrist, but
it's not like he's running away, you know?
Right.
No, he wants to serve.
And that was one of the things he told me too. He said they probably knew all along, at least on some level, what I was doing. And they probably knew that it was a ruse, but you have to remember, Mike, this was 1952, and it was so rare to find anybody who actually wanted to go to Korea.
Exactly.
That's probably why they never asked any questions.
But you know, there's that saying about beg for forgiveness instead of ask for permission.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's a thing. But I really, this pigeonholing thing is a very important thing right now, as it's not just this country. I feel like we're in a reinvention mode. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, politics, let's not even, I mean, everybody's resigning and being, you know, put away or whatever, you know, across the around the world. It's just like, what the heck is going on? So there is reinvention and maybe a renaissance going on political leadership. But there's also personal reinvention going on for people. And it's very important to kind of figure out who you are and what you want to do and stay true to that. And it's maybe you have to do other things to make that happen, but it's very difficult. You musicians that we interview, artists, writers, look what you do. You know who you are, this is history. That's your thing, you know, whether you're teaching, doing speaking engagement, writing, you know, that's who you are. And I think that's a very, you have to have self-respect to be able to pull it off. And know yourself and give yourself that breath. An artist cannot do good art that's authentic without having the integrity to the art that they're supposed to make and create. A musician can't do it. So I think it's really important, whether you're in a corporate job and going through college. I mean, I know you teach. Isn't this a very good and important lesson for college students to, you know, it's hard. I mean, going to college, maybe you didn't want to do what you're doing and then you want to change and you have to really do a shift there, and people might get mad at you because it's expensive. Yeah. So I think that's a good lesson. Nancy, you've been good at that. You know, don't pigeonhole. We're the blend. You can't pigeonhole us, right?
No, the thing is, you know, the more you learn, the more you shift your ideas. And then you're like, oh, I'm going to go and do this. And then, you know, 6 months later with a bit of education, go, oh man, I really want to go do that. And then so you shift over and you start doing that. And then it's like, oh man, I really want to go do that over there.
But that's a good point, you know? Too, because, and, he wouldn't have been able to pull that off without him knowing about where there's a weakness to be able to go, hey, I want to go here. So did he like know how the communication was between the different places, the different, you know, stations, do you think?
He had to have known about it on some level. I mean, you know, for him to plan it out like that, I bet he knew that there were going to be some points of friction and that, you know, the information wouldn't exactly be real time across all the channels. So,
Wow.
You know, I think when a person's that dedicated, and it's not like he's doing something bad, you know, it's not like he's trying to run away. He's running towards something. And you know, to me, if you're a leader, you would take one good look at that and like, hey, let him run. Let's help him, as opposed to oppose him, just so that you can say, you have to do what I told you to do.
Right.
It's like thinking ahead and thinking, well, what's our end goal? If this guy wants to do this and it's a good thing, it's going to help.
But isn't that also good leaders?
Let him do it.
Good leaders want to hire people with more ideas than themselves. You know, they always say, like Richard Branson always talks about that. Mm-hmm. Hire people, maybe younger or not. You know, age isn't always a thing, but who have fresh ideas. and let mm-hmm. them run with it. Don't be, you know, I think ego gets in the way. What do you think, Micah? Do you think ego kind of stands in the way of people being able, like, you have to have a certain amount sure. of chutzpah, ego to do it, but
yeah,
as a leader, you have to get over yourself to be able to let the good stuff happen to achieve the goal.
Right.
No, sometimes when you look at how we are now, like Lisa, you're saying the political this and that is not so good. I think that our leaders are way too old. They're too old.
Uh-oh.
They've been in office for so long. And, you know, with the advent of the
She's waiting for you to run for office, Mike.
Yeah, do it. You know,
I have to take a shower every 5 minutes.
Yeah, really. You know, it's like with the internet, things are so fast. You know, like we get in information so fast compared to 30 years ago, you know, and I'm thinking when people are on the field and they're going into combat, we have information now that you can barely get it to the people that need to have it before new information comes in again and it's all changed. I think it's far more, on the one hand, information, yes, it's good. It's a good thing to get the information as fast as possible, but it's almost too much too fast. And can you get it where it needs to be? And how to, like, I don't know, like when I think of somebody going into combat, it's like, oh yeah, go over here and do this. And then no, go over there and do that. No, go over here and do that. You know, I think it's way more difficult than people who haven't been in the armed forces to really assimilate and understand that. You know, I look at it, I'm like, this seems way out there. Like, because we, at least at my age, we're brought up thinking the military, it's this, 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 and you do it over and over and over so you get it right. Mm-hmm. And so that it's second nature. But I don't know if that works today with how fast things change.
Well, no, but it's not even today. But I mean, if you read all of Mike's books, Hal Moore, you know, Paul mm-hmm. Gorman, Russell Volkman. I mean, and he, like, talk about a badass. We get mm-hmm. to talk about him in the next show, right?
Sure.
Thank you. Because he, you know, like, these are all people that, yeah, you've got your training, but they extended out no yeah. matter what happened. They said, okay, we can't conform exactly what you were talking about with Paul Gorman. Mm-hmm. You can't stay in that box and survive through mm-hmm. this and achieve your goal. You have to bust the mold yep, out of survival. Right. And Hal Moore did that too, really. Mm-hmm. A lot of that, you know. But JD Vanderpool, that's our next hero yeah. here. That's your next book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Coyote cool. Recon. What's the coyote that's, about?
Okay, so there is actually kind name. Of a funny story about how I came across that title. So at first, I really wanted to title it Ghost Recon, you know, because I figured, okay, well, JD Vanderpool, you know, he's moving in and out of these enemy areas. He's kind of a ghost. And to me, the title Ghost Recon really sounded cool. It really sounded tough. But then I found out that Ghost Recon is actually a registered trademark to Ubisoft, and it's part of a video game series that I had yeah. no knowledge of. So I'm thinking, okay, well, gosh, it's registered trademark. That removes any possibility of me actually yeah. using it as a title. So I started thinking to myself, okay, well, can't use the title that I first really wanted to use right off the bat. So what else do I have? I'll say, well, I want to keep Recon in there somewhere. So what do I want to do? Do I want to call it Fox Recon? That sounds okay, but I don't know, what's another type of predatory animal that I can use? And I was like, okay, well, Fox Recon, I think I can do better than that. So at one point, I literally just got on Google and I said, list of predatory animals, hit search. And I said, okay, well, let's see what the almighty Google has to tell me. So I'm like, okay, bear, no. Lion, no. Snake, mm-mm. Yeah.
Are we back to the creepy crawlies, Mike, from our conversation before we hit the yeah. record button?
And then I saw jackal. I'm like, And then hyena. And I'm like, come on, no. seriously? And then I went down the list to coyote. And I saw coyote. And I'm like, oh, that's it. Coyote Recon. And then that's when I remembered, hey, coyote is slang for somebody who smuggles people across borders.
Right.
And that is exactly what Jay Vanderpool was doing when he was a special operations leader. He was, smuggling people across borders into the Philippines during World War II. You know, cool. He was doing the same thing in North Korea when he was, in charge of partisan operations there. I'm just thinking, man, that's a perfect title. And then Coyote Recon, it flows. That's my title.
That's awesome. That's cool. Very yeah. Cool. He's based in Minnesota, right?
He actually grew up in Oklahoma and he retired to Sarasota, Florida. And that's where he lived out the rest of his days.
So. So how did you find out about him?
So I first came across Vanderpool's name actually when I was doing research on Volkman and Blackburn. And, I really came across his name just, as another American person who was involved in coordinating guerrilla operations there. And I never really circled back to it too much. Then it was one of my Facebook followers who was commenting on some other post I made. He said, hey, Mike, have you ever considered doing a biography on Jay Vanderpool? And I said, Vanderpool, I remember that name. I remember coming across him as one of the liaisons to the guerrilla movements that were happening in Luzon. And I said, but I never really dug too deep into what else he's done. I mean, if he's done anything else at all. And I started digging a little deeper. And that's when I found out this guy has an incredible career behind him. And not only that, I mean, his life story and his upbringing, even before he got into the military, was really just nothing short of amazing. And I said, okay, well, gosh, he's done all this. How is there not a book out there on this guy? And how can I find any more? How can I find any more information about him? So I went back to a lot of my old reliable contacts over at the Army War College and the Military History Institute there. And I said, hey, is there anything at all that you have on this guy? And it turns out that there was a big oral history that was done on him that has been sitting on the shelves in their archives for years. So I was able to get access to that. I was able to get access to a bunch of the information they had. Started looking for any other publications where he might have been mentioned or just anything that he contributed by his own hand. Found a lot of stuff. I knew it was going to be a challenge right off the bat because I started looking into his genealogy and he has been dead for almost 30 years now. And so many of his family members and people who had real-time knowledge of him have also passed on. Mm. For instance, he's passed away. All of his brothers have passed away. His wife passed away about 20 years ago. And
So that's hard.
Produced no children. Yeah. So he had no children from his marriage. And I think his last surviving niece just passed away 2 years ago.
Wow.
Oh, man.
So I was like, I think the one person who may have had any kind of real-time knowledge about Jay Vanderpool, also passed away. So I'm thinking, okay, well, most of what I have to do, I have to rely on, rely on genealogical records or any archival material that I can find. But it has been a thrill ride so far because that book, I've found out an amazing laundry list of stories and all of these near brushes with death. And I'm just thinking, man, he fits perfectly right within the type of stories that I love telling.
That's awesome. It's exciting.
And tumble upbringings, and man, just make an entire career out of saving lives and doing great things that nobody hears about.
Awesome. I'm so glad that that's exciting because I know it's you're working on it coming out soon in the fall, and so you're right in it. But do their stories keep you up at night? Yeah, because to me, I'll sit and write articles in my head and then go, what the hell? Why didn't I write it down? Get up, that Seinfeld thing where he tells a joke on a little piece of yellow paper and it disappears. Yeah, because there's stories. I mean, I always say this on the shows with you, you're carrying the torch. Look at that. For him, he's passed on. I mean, there's no family carrying that torch for him. but to tell his story, and then everybody that he was in contact and worked with, you know, you always put the stories first. And so we get to have that human connection that we so badly need, right. You know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important. I always talk about, okay, the civilian side, but for the rest of the, you know, military and those who have served and armed forces and, you know, you're part of that. It's a connection too. Everybody wants mm-hmm. to know those stories. And I think it's super cool that you're doing it. So tell us mm-hmm. one, why he gets to be part of the life lessons. So he's saving people. That's cool.
Yeah, he is. And I think the biggest life lesson there, at least one that I can think of right offhand, is to never be afraid to exert as many resources as you can if you know that it's going to help people and you know that there's going to be a very big downstream benefit of it. Because there is this one incident in what will be chapter 3 of the book where he expends a lot of time and a lot of artillery ammunition taking care of one small little Japanese machine gun nest. And, mm-hmm. you know, he is directing what amounts to an entire battery's worth of fire onto this one target. And he catches hell from his battalion leadership because of it. They're like, you know, Jay, of all the targets that we have, why are mm-hmm. you wasting so much battery fire on, you know, on this one little machine gun nest that is on an island that's, you know, only 100 yards offshore from where the infantry regiment's going? And he said, look, I had to do it because it's a small machine gun nest, right? But if you take a look at the operational schematics, this one machine gun nest, because of its position and where it was concealed, it was holding up the entire right flank of the regiment's advance. And if they got too separated from the left flank, the whole operation would have fallen apart. So I am not the least bit sorry. Don't expect me to apologize for, you know, for wasting a bunch of 105 artillery shells on this, because once I silenced that machine gun nest, that's what allowed that right flank to catch up to the left flank.
He sounds like Shaka Zulu, you know?
Yeah.
Circling, he's got it, you know?
I never want to play pool with him.
Oh man, that's awesome.
That's smart. Yeah. I mean, you see, that's it. That's going back to what we're talking about with Hal Moore about being cool and not reactionary and just going, this is the I don't want to do that, but yeah, but you don't, you know, it's thinking beyond and going, you know, again with Paul Gorman, thinking beyond the box, you know, it's always those hidden, the devil is in the details, right?
Man,
all those little things. Well, I'm excited about this book now.
Yeah,
so it's when do you too. Think fall so do you, cool. are you allowed to say when or
yeah
not ready
so
to?
Yeah, so it is most definitely coming out this fall, and cool. It is going to be, and I will let all of the viewers and readers know that it is going to be out in time for Black Friday. So it'll be out for the Christmas rush.
Nice. Oh, yeah, very smart. Very,
maybe a few
very
weeks
good.
Before, so.
Yeah. It has to be there for Cyber. We need to have a book, like, you know, we have Cyber Monday and stuff, but we should have like a book thing. I think we need a new holiday just for authors and musicians. That's what, you know,
wouldn't that be
put
cool?
It is Cyber Monday, but still, you know. Mm. So are you going to do an audio book with it?
Oh, yeah, I sure am. And as a matter of fact, spoiler alert, this is going to be one of the first audio books that I narrate myself.
Right on. That's cool. Awesome. That is cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good idea. That is a good idea. And I think it's something, mm-hmm. it's obviously a passion project. It's developed into something really, you know, special for you. So I'm excited. We'll finish it now. Okay. get it done. We're ready.
Yes,
you know.
Ma'am.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Military Mike, we're excited for our next episode on, you know, leadership and life lessons from military heroes. So right. I do want Volkman in the next one, if possible. I was like, oh, he's not putting him in. I want him in there. And Don Stark. I mean, but then it's like, how do we pick three and only do two shows on them? Because these are really cool stories. And I think people can really grasp onto them. And the most important thing is everyone go get the books. Yeah.
I think it's really important that civilians see people who protect us as real people.
Yes.
Instead of like numbers, as real people with real personalities, with families, and see the things that they did, as opposed to like newspaper articles. I just think they're so lame.
It is sacrifice. And you also said something really good about Jay Vanderpool, that doing something that's going to save people or help people in a greater thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that is a huge life lesson. When the chips are down, we tend to focus on ourselves. And sometimes you need to focus in something bigger than yourself to pull yourself out. And I think that is a very big lesson to learn. And I think that's, you know, what you were talking about with him, helping, you know, helping people and saving people. We may not be able to save everybody or save people around us, you know, if we're not in the military or, you know, armed, you know, defender or, you know, but we can do things for the greater good and put ourselves out there. And I think that's a really big life lesson, because you will feel better if you're feeling, feeling blue, go help somebody or help an animal.
Yeah. Go
or
volunteer.
Something, you know, exactly. Yeah. It'll move you forward. So, but everyone, again, Mike's website is mikeguardia.com, and he's on Facebook. He's on YouTube. Go. Oh my God. Follow him on YouTube. Holy cow. You are busy on YouTube. When do you get time to actually write your books? You do such a great job on YouTube.
Burn a lot of midnight oil.
Yeah, I'm like, dude, he's been busy, but very cool for people to follow. And then also, of course, go to Amazon and you'll find Mike there. Just type in Mike Guardia and keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. Mike is on every first Monday. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike, and for sharing the stories.
Thank you, ladies. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you.